Stop me, would you, if you've heard this one before? The White House is working on new tariffs, except this time, it's different. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Wednesday today, the 2nd of October. Good as always to have you along, everybody. At the risk of making your already trade-addled brain just a little bit more addled, there is news today of tariffs. Not, however, tariffs that the Trump administration is imposing because it can. No, these are tariffs, 10% on airplanes coming from the European Union, 25% on EU industrial and agricultural products that are going to be imposed, the White House said today, because the World Trade Organization said it was okay. The U.S. won a round at the WTO this morning, a case where the EU was accused of giving unfair subsidies to the European plane maker Airbus. $7.5 billion worth of European Union exports to this country can be taxed, that is per year, to compensate the U.S. for the damage the subsidies have wrought. There is, we should say, a mirror image case being brought by the EU against the United States over Boeing. That one's not resolved yet. But the point is that this brouhaha over airplanes, which took 15 years, count them, 15 years to get resolved, is how trade disputes are supposed to work. Marketplace's Sabri Benishore gets us going.
Going to the WTO is like going to court.
It is a legal proceeding, getting information together, compiling your arguments, making the arguments before the different panels.
Nicole Bivens-Collinson is with law firm Sandler, Travis & Rosenberg. One country will basically sue another country for breaking trade rules. The WTO decides who wins and then basically awards damages.
They will then render a decision that, you know, we determined that your injury in this case was X amount of dollars, and therefore you, United States or whatever other country, are entitled to take action.
Take action like slapping tariffs on goods from the country that hurt you. That's what happened today between the U.S. and the EU. But the Trump administration, for the most part, has not been settling trade disputes this way. For example, with China.
China obviously was a very different case because the U.S. didn't bring anything to the WTO.
Rufus Yerxa is president of the National Foreign Trade Council and a former deputy U.S. trade representative. With China, the U.S. just basically on its own imposed tariffs. It also on its own imposed tariffs on many countries' steel and aluminum exports. James Backus is professor of global affairs at the University of Central Florida and former chairman of the WTO's appellate body.
Unilateral action leads to the exercise of the rule of power. Reliance on the WTO upholds the rule of law.
And the rule of law, he says, is better for global trade in the long run. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishore for Marketplace.
You'll have noticed by this point in your day, I imagine, that the 2nd of October 2019 was not a great day for stocks. I don't know whether traders woke up this morning and looked around and all of a sudden realized the trade war's not going away, or maybe they were put off by a not-as-strong-as-expected report on private sector employment from the payroll processing firm ADP this morning. ADP is one of our underwriters, by the way. Or maybe it was the gnawing feeling that the slowing global economy is creeping ever closer to our shores. Oh, and don't forget the manufacturing numbers that we told you about yesterday. Whatever the reason, the R word is being bandied about. But what if there's another way things could go? That maybe, and this isn't our original idea, economists and market watchers, also a friend of the show, Neil Irwin of the New York Times, maybe the other side of economic expansion and solid growth, they say, isn't recession. It's just meh. Lasting, enduring meh. Marketplace's Kimberly Adams looks at what it might mean if we just stick with mediocre growth for a while.
Slow or slowing growth is really a relative thing. It's just slow compared to our recent experience. Jana Remes is an economist and partner at McKinsey Global Institute.
When you think about looking ahead, it's not at all clear that that momentum that we all have so used to think of as the normal rate of growth will be sustainable.
But slow growth, even over the long term, is different than an ongoing negative growth rate over time. That's what makes a recession. Chun Wong is a portfolio manager at the Luthold Group.
A slowdown, you might get no, say, pay raise. But a recession, you might lose a job.
A slowdown versus a recession also prompts different government responses. If it's just a slowdown, says Wong, when it comes to interest rates,
You expect the Fed to cut maybe two, three times. But if you're heading towards a real recession, this is going to be a full easing cycle, 8, 9, 10, or even more cuts.
If a recession is an economic emergency, then
the slow growth is kind of a dull headache, to be frank.
Todd Mickelson owns the company Spray Rack in Minnesota. He makes equipment to test the waterproofing on windows and doors. Mickelson says slow growth isn't ideal, but it's the fear of recession that has him holding off on things like hiring.
So whether it's slow growth or a recession, I mean, the unpredictability does cause a problem for me and other small business owners that I know.
Because even if a recession is bad, at least you know. You know? In Washington, I'm Kimberly Adams for Marketplace.
I'm going to go out on a limb here. It is going to be the Wawas. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Our China correspondent Jennifer Pak's been doing some reporting to mark the 70th anniversary of the People's Republic of China yesterday, for the record, October the 1st. President Trump has been clear that Beijing's been the big winner in the U.S.-China trade relationship, so Jennifer set out to find some of the people benefiting from that winning. She started yesterday with a factory worker who has prospered, but at real personal cost. Today we hear from her son. Here's Jennifer.
Nie Pengyu was just 14 when his mother left their village in central Henan province for work. She ended up here, 900 miles away in Dongguan City. A year later, in 2004, his father joined his mother, leaving Nie Pengyu and his 5-year-old sister to be raised by their grandparents.
Not having my parents around was tough. There was nobody to keep us in line or help us with schoolwork.
Their education suffered, and they were far from the only ones. Around 60 million children were left behind in the countryside when their parents went off to work in the cities, according to several studies.
It's really hard for these kids to make it to university without parents to supervise them.
Sun Zhongwei is an associate professor of sociology at the East China University of Science and Technology. He says in many cases, cities don't allow migrants' children to sign up for school, unless their parents are officially registered there. And that registration process is long and hard. After Nie Pengyu finished junior high in his home village, he quit school.
In our village, there weren't many companies to work for, so I followed my parents at Dongguan.
At first, he worked alongside his mother at a shoe factory. Then he tried a few other jobs, but he didn't like any of them.
It was just the same thing, day in, day out, so boring. And I really wanted to start my own business.
But he says he had few options and few skills, though he did learn embroidery at one factory. His parents helped him buy 3 big machines that can sew tags and embroider designs on shoes, and then he hired 2 workers. These machines can get through up to 600 pairs of shoes a day. Nie Pengyu estimates half of the shoes he works on end up in America, which is a problem, because uncertainty over further tariffs, he says, is putting off his clients from ordering.
Right now, I'm getting 20 to 30% fewer orders than I was getting 2 years ago.
Migrant workers' children have far more options if they manage to get into university. People like Hu Maoling, who's majoring in chemical engineering.
My cousin is the chief engineer of a chemical factory, so I plan to work with him after I graduate.
And on semester breaks, he's happy to work in factories like Longhou Shoes that make work boots for the U.S. market. Though he says, as far as trade goes, the Americans get at least as good a deal as the Chinese.
Like, we make these shoes for American brands, and they sell them in the U.S. They pay us to produce them, but a lot of the profit goes to the American retailers.
As Communist China marks its 70th birthday, most people say the economic reforms carried out by the party have certainly improved their lives. Again, Associate Professor of Sociology, Sun Zhongwei.
Nowadays, even migrant workers can afford to eat meat every day. They can earn enough to renovate their village homes or buy a property in a nearby town. So I think every migrant worker has benefited from China's economic reforms.
But he says he's not sure the gains outweigh the huge sacrifices migrant workers have made, like living hundreds of miles away from their families and their homes. In Dongguan City, I'm Jennifer Pak for Marketplace.
Jennifer wraps up her series on the People's Republic of China at 70 tomorrow. How Nye Peng Yu's uncle has gotten by as the Chinese economy has grown. We heard from Detroit this morning. Car sales, SUVs and pickup trucks did all right last month. Sedans, less so. Cheap gas, it seems. But it's how Americans are buying their cars that's interesting. Borrowing more money for longer. 7 years, in fact, for a car loan. That's according to Ben Eisen reporting in the Wall Street Journal. Ben, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
So I'll tell you what, 7 years sounds like a really long time to be paying off a car.
Yeah, it's a term that's really extended over the last decade or so.
What has happened? How come this is happening?
Well, what you've seen is car prices have really gone up a lot, and they've risen a lot faster than incomes have, and it's just gotten more and more difficult to afford a car. Cars have gotten fancier, they've gotten safer, they've gotten more technologically advanced. So what people are doing instead is they're taking out longer auto loans, which basically helps them manage the payments, keep the monthly payment relatively affordable, but you're paying your car down for a lot longer period of time.
Right. And the car winds up being more expensive because you're paying interest on that loan. What's the root cause here? Yes, wages and cars are more expensive, but how did we get here?
Well, it's something that you really see sort of across the entire economy, just that for middle-class people, this doesn't apply to the richest people as much, but it's just gotten harder and harder to maintain that sort of middle-class lifestyle. Everything's gotten more expensive. The biggest costs have gotten more expensive, and yet incomes haven't risen to keep pace.
People are looking for these loans. I imagine banks and lending institutions are more than happy to provide, yeah?
Yeah, absolutely. When you look at auto loans, they've been a pretty good investment over the last decade. If you're an investor looking for something that provides a lot of income and, you know, a treasury bond is yielding a very low amount, right, you know, this is a good investment. The question is whether it will continue to be a good investment. You know, when you lengthen the term of an auto loan, the chances of losses go up a lot because, you know, there's just more time for someone to have a life event that, you know, causes them to stop paying their auto loan or, you know, something else can happen in the interim.
Yeah. So the finance industry is making some money off of this, mostly. What about dealerships? Are they doing all right with this?
Yeah, this is one place where the auto industry has really changed. What you've seen is dealers, you know, back in the day used to make their money from the margin on the sale of the car, but that's gotten more difficult. You can go online now and find out exactly how much you're supposed to pay. So it's kind of harder to squeeze out money on the showroom floor. But what they're doing instead is they're kind of squeezing out that profit in the finance manager's office. They're also using that to kind of pitch add-ons, insurance, extended warranties, and sort of other things that get rolled into the loan. So altogether, the loan becomes kind of the product itself at the dealership, right, rather than the car.
And are people buying more expensive cars because the monthly payment is, in theory anyway, lower?
I mean, some people definitely are. We talked to a lot of people for this article who, ended up buying, you know, very nice cars, but they paid a lot more than they expected to. Yeah. They looked at the monthly payment and that sort of allowed them to kind of budget out, kind of create a heuristic for themselves of what they could afford on a monthly basis. But then looking at it over a much longer period of time, they end up paying a lot more than they thought they would.
Ben Eisen, he covers banking at the Wall Street Journal. Ben, thanks a lot.
Thanks for having me.
Coming up,
we don't need more climbing gear, just for the record.
Tackling one of the biggest challenges married couples face. But first, let's do the numbers. Look, I got it right. The Wawa's. Dow Industrial's down. I don't get the pick. The Dow Industrial's off 494 points today, 1.8%, 26,078. The NASDAQ down 123, 1.5%. finished at 77.85. The S&P 500 gave up 52 points, 1.7%, 28.87. They're a lousy day for airline stocks. Delta said today that those new tariffs on Airbus products will hurt profits and inflict, quote, serious harm. Shares in Delta ended the session down 4.6%. United down 4.7%. American Airlines dropped 5.3%. News of the tariffs didn't do much for Airbus's rival Boeing. It lost 2%. Johnson & Johnson settled a couple of Ohio lawsuits stemming from the opioid crisis. Sent shares in the drug maker up 1.5%. Today, you're listening to Marketplace.
Hey, everyone. I'm Rima Khres, host of This is Uncomfortable, a new podcast from Marketplace that explores the thing we're always in our feelings over, but don't really know how to talk about: money. This is a storytelling podcast that digs into things like how someone can feel like an imposter when they move from one socioeconomic class to another, or why so many people lie about what's in their bank account. We'll even teach you how to ask everyone you know about how much they make. But just to be clear, this is not a personal finance podcast. It is a podcast about life and how money messes with it. Subscribe now wherever you get your podcasts.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. I learned something new today, that every year the United States Trade Representative comes out with something called, and this is the actual title, the Notorious Markets List. Notorious, apparently, for being markets, both real and online, where counterfeit goods are sold. Places like the Grand Bazaar in Istanbul and the Silk Market in Beijing. Some shady-looking websites also. And if the American Apparel and Footwear Association has its way, Amazon. Specifically, its websites in France and India. The trade group asked the government to put Amazon on the list this week. Marketplace's Mariel Segarra reports now on Amazon's counterfeit problem.
If you go to Amazon.com and type in Louis Vuitton, on the very first page of search results, you will see counterfeits. There's a case for your Apple AirPods. It costs $16.99. And there it is. Looks like the Louis Vuitton logo splashed across the front. But there are no AirPod cases on Louis Vuitton's website. Susan Scafidi, who directs the Fashion Law Institute at Fordham University, says you got to understand how Amazon works.
We have in our minds the image of a giant warehouse from which initially books and later everything we could possibly want in life flows to us directly. But in fact, any number of sellers are selling product on Amazon that Amazon never touches, has no control over.
Also, sometimes these products are delivered by Amazon, but it just doesn't catch that they're fakes. Counterfeits are a huge problem for retailers. Maybe a customer buys a counterfeit Ralph Lauren shirt, we found one on Amazon, and it falls apart. That can hurt the brand. Michael Londrigan at the Business and Fashion College, LIM, says it's even worse for an up-and-coming company.
Those are the ones that really get hurt, because those are the ones that can't afford the brand tarnishing.
Amazon hasn't been held legally responsible for the counterfeits on its sites. In a statement, the company said it has spent hundreds of millions of dollars fighting fraud and that it quickly takes down listings for fakes. Londrigan says it'll be hard for Amazon to catch everybody.
With the amount of business that they do all around the world, it is virtually impossible, obviously, to stop them all.
The AAFA, the trade group, asked the government to put Amazon on the Notorious Markets List last year, but it didn't happen. I'm Mariel Segarra for Marketplace.
Mariel's doing some experiential journalism for the Marketplace cause. She is going to order some of the questionable merchandise she mentioned in that story. We'll get you an update when she gets them. All right, I'm going to name some companies. You are going to tell me what they all have in common, all right? Uber, Lyft. They're not all rideshare companies, by the way, so hold on. Peloton, also Smile Direct. Figure it out. All of them had not great initial public offerings this year. WeWork is, of course, the IPO cherry on top. The company put the kibosh on going public after we all got a look at its financials and corporate structure a couple of weeks ago. As Marketplace's Justin Ho reports, all of this is having some real implications for the IPO industrial complex.
If a company cancels its IPO, it's giving up all that cash it had been planning on raising.
And that company, which would have had expansion plans, has to go into kind of a contraction mode.
That's Kathleen Smith at Renaissance Capital. She says that often means putting off hiring, maybe even layoffs. Plus, the lawyers that prepare documents, the accountants that do the audit work, they don't earn fees.
And so it does have an effect on the real economy when the IPO market starts to shut down.
Investment banks also play a big role in the IPO process and earn millions in fees. Mike Mayo, a bank analyst at Wells Fargo Securities, says the weak IPO market comes at a time when banks are making less in other departments, like bond and stock trading. So if the IPO slowdown lasts a while, Mayo says banks could start cutting costs.
One half of bank expenses are what employees make and the number of employees. So you could see some reduction in compensation costs.
Companies are also questioning the IPO process itself. Some are starting to list their shares directly on a stock exchange. That lets them bypass the investment banks that help shepherd traditional IPOs. Paul Kodrowski is a partner at the venture capital firm SK Ventures.
Whenever you get underwriters, investment banks involved in the process, that they charge high fees and have an incentive to underprice the offering because that does a favor for their investors.
Direct listings aren't for everybody. They raise money for private investors by letting them sell their shares, but don't create new shares that would raise money for the company itself. Airbnb is reportedly thinking about going public that way in 2020. In New York, I'm Justin Ho for Marketplace.
A couple of weeks ago, we asked you a question. If you're married, we wanted to know, how do you and your partner deal with your finances? Well, a whole lot of different ways, it turns out. We asked as a way to jumpstart our new coverage of you and your personal economy. Check Your Balance, we're calling it. Marketplace's Samantha Fields dug into what you had to say.
The thing about sharing all of your money with someone else is that they can see everything you buy, as Virginia Lacey Hilliard has learned.
There are some transactions that I make that he is laughing about and asking me how many beauty products can one have.
Or she'd ask her husband, Nick, how much climbing gear?
We don't need more climbing gear, just for the record, but that is a point of disagreement.
So yeah, they do have some disagreements over how they spend money.
Yes.
But usually they're pretty minor and they're able to keep a sense of humor about it. And big picture, 5 years in, they feel like it's helping them reach their goals, maxing out retirement, saving for vacations.
We kind of look at the bigger things, but then don't freak out over the small stuff.
That is pretty much exactly what Ty and Talat McNeely tell couples through their site, hisandhermoney.com. Pool everything, but also talk about it a lot.
If you have joint accounts without a joint vision, without a joint plan, without joint conversations, then yeah, that's not going to work.
Talat and Ty almost didn't get married because of money. They'd had all the right conversations before the wedding, only Talat wasn't completely upfront at first.
I think that he thought that I was going to judge him because of his money and because of his credit score, because of his debt, and that wasn't the case.
Clearly, they worked through it, and now his finances are her finances. For them, there's power in that, in combining forces. But for other people, like Cherie Garcia Cooper, there's power in not combining forces, in being fully in control of her own finances, after being a stay-at-home mom and then going through a divorce.
There were times when I had $17 in my pocket, and the kids and I would play a game on how many groceries can we get for $17. So I swore that I would never, ever be in that situation again.
So when she remarried last year, she and her new husband, Josh, decided to just keep things as they were and figure out how to split stuff, like their mortgage, bills, groceries, so that it feels fair.
It just makes things so much easier. And then it gives me the peace of mind.
I do think the data we have is showing that this is much more common than even a couple of decades ago.
Joanna Pepin is a researcher at the University of Texas who studies what couples do with their money. And actually, even though the majority of married couples do combine everything, most people, when asked how they thought other couples should manage their money, keep it all together, separate, or somewhere in between.
The majority of people thought that couples, whether married or not, should take that hybrid approach of sharing some money and keeping some money separate.
That is what Steph and Seth Miller do. They've been married for about 4 years, and they put almost everything into one big pot. But they each still have one account that's just theirs. Because, she says,
we also are still two different human beings who have our own things that we want to accomplish in life as well.
For the things they want to accomplish together, they make a point of talking about their finances every single Sunday, for half an hour max.
We both feel so good about it. money is not really a stress for us in our marriage anymore.
It's been great for their finances and for their relationship. I'm Samantha Fields for Marketplace.
More stories of you and your personal economy, like saving for college or dealing with a surprise medical bill, at marketplace.org/checkyourbalance. This final note on the way out today, which I will preface by saying I am just a lousy, lousy typist, both on a regular keyboard and on my phone. The rest of you, though, are apparently doing pretty well. Researchers at Cambridge University over in the UK did the research how well and how quickly we type with our thumbs versus all 10 digits on a regular keyboard. 36.2 words per minute on a phone, which is only about 25% slower than on a regular keyboard, which frankly is faster than I'd have thought. Okay, that's it. We got to go. Dow off 494 today, 1.8%. The NASDAQ off 123 points, 1.5%. S&P 500 gave up 52 points, 1.7%. Our media production team includes Sarah Berger, Drew Josta, Jeff Peters, Daniel Ramirez, Jay Siebold, Charlton Thorpe, and Ben Holliday. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.